15. Dating games, real and staged. Cheryl and I had a few more chaste movie dates like this, with me curating the programming. We saw WUSA, a political thriller starring Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman. After that, Airport. She did not object when I held her hand and put an arm around her shoulder. Still, I couldn't summon the nerve to kiss her. But on Burroughs High School's homecoming weekend, I sensed an opportunity. There was a dance scheduled for the evening after the football game. I went to the game as a spectator. Cheryl was there with the drill team. She had on her red and white Burroughs uniform, which included a short, fringed skirt that did disorienting things to my brain. That night, we danced up a storm. She had good moves. I didn't. Then the dance was over. I drove Cheryl back to her house in my VW Bug. It was time to see her to the door and say goodnight. Damn it, I was still too nervous to pull the trigger. But then, while we were still sitting in the car, Cheryl looked left, right, up, down, with some concern. "I can't find my purse," she said. "I must have left it back at the school." So we drove all the way back to Burroughs, which was now virtually abandoned. We looked everywhere for her purse. No luck. Well, no luck in that regard, anyway. We found ourselves standing alone in front of the high school. I went for it. I kissed her on the lips. Cheryl did not pull away. In fact, she welcomed the kiss. Then we kissed some more. Our first kiss was quickly followed by our second, our third, our fourth, our fifth, probably in the neighborhood of our 37th kiss. When we got back to the car, she rooted under the passenger seat and pulled something up. Her purse. "It was here all along," she said. Cheryl later admitted to me that the missing purse thing had been a ruse. "I just didn't want the date to end," she said. I was fully in love by Christmas. The more time I spent with Cheryl, the more I couldn't believe my good fortune. By that point in my life, I had developed a keen sense of who among the kids at my school was just curious about meeting Opie and who was genuinely interested in me. Cheryl was definitely in the latter category. More important than that, she had a quiet individualism and an energy for tackling challenges that I had never seen in someone my own age. She had already soloed in her father's plane on her 16th birthday. She was well-liked by the popular girls in our grade at Burroughs, but she wasn't of them. When she was rushed to join the class sorority, she politely declined. She didn't give a damn about social status. Cheryl's father, Charles, was a Louisiana native who looked and dressed like the aerospace-era scientist he was. Crew cut, black horn-rimmed glasses, gray slacks, and a short-sleeved dress shirt with a pin protector in the front pocket. Decades later, when I gave him a walk-on part in Apollo 13 as one of the Grumman engineers who were advising the mission control guys, I told my wardrobe department to leave Mr. Alley alone. His regular work clothes would do just fine. But his tan, weathered skin betrayed that Mr. Alley wasn't as straight-laced as he initially appeared. As a teen, he hopped freight trains to get himself to the 1933-34 World's Fair in Chicago. And he later worked on icebreaker ships in the North Pacific and panned for gold in Mexico. Cheryl's mother, Vivian, had run away from her family's Wisconsin farm when she was only 14, fleeing abusive relatives. She made her way to California by working as an au pair and waitress. When she was only 21, Vivian got pregnant by Charles, who was almost 17 years her senior. They married as a result, with Cheryl being their firstborn. Two more girls, Cheryl's sisters Sandra and Floyce, came after her. Her parents divorced when Cheryl was in her early teens, but she had inherited the best of them, her father's intellectual curiosity and her mother's kindness and heart. Though our households were very different, Cheryl was a remarkably self-sufficient, latchkey kid, whereas I was the highly supervised son of a tight nuclear family. I saw some similarities in our backgrounds. We were both the products of parents who took unconventional paths in life and didn't care what anyone else thought of their choices. Cheryl had this trait too, more so than me. She wasn't a follower. If anything, she was an agitator. She railed against Burroughs High School's policy of not allowing girls to take auto shop class because she wanted to learn how to repair a car. And she thought it unfair that Burroughs didn't have a track program for girls. She had been a skilled sprinter in middle school. With a friend, she lobbied the school administration to create such a program, which finally came into being shortly after we graduated.
By the time Cheryl came along, I'd begun to consider an adult career as a sports writer. Fledgling journalist that I was, I looked up Cheryl's stats when she entered Ron's life. She held the record in the 220-yard dash at her junior high, Luther Burbank Middle School. Ron was impressed by Cheryl's athletic prowess. As they got more serious, I think he may have been harboring dreams of breeding jocks.
One evening, as we walked to my car after a movie, I leaned in to kiss Cheryl, and she pushed me away playfully and took off while wearing suede saddle shoes. I gave chase. I was pretty confident in my running abilities. I was one of the quicker players on my basketball team and a base stealer on my baseball team. But as I chased Cheryl, I noticed that I wasn't closing in on her. So I decided, fine, I'll kick into high gear, catch up to her, and then swing her into my arms for that kiss. As I accelerated, though, she turned on the afterburners and shot off like a bullet. My girlfriend, I discovered, had some serious wheels. She finally eased up and flashed a coquettish look over her shoulder. That's when, panting like a dog left out too long in the sun, I got my kiss. As we got to know each other better, Cheryl told me that she was attracted to me because, unlike a lot of boys in our class, I didn't seem full of myself. She liked that, counter to expectations and stereotypes, I didn't act like a television star. I didn't drive a flashy car. Thank goodness my parents nixed my getting the Barracuda. If anything, my status as an actor was a potential detriment. Her father owned an apartment building. Some of his tenants were actors, and they were the worst about paying their rent on time. Cheryl also told me that her father had never asked to approve my first date choice of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. While I had waited on the phone with bated breath, she was looking up the movie in the newspaper listings to see its rating, which was G. Cheryl was raised in a strict Southern Baptist household, and she wouldn't have gone out with a guy who proposed seeing a PG movie on the first date or, God forbid, wanted to sneak into an R-rated picture. I spent the days before Christmas zipping around Southern California in my bug, picking up the component parts of the present that I was customizing for Cheryl. She was a pilot, so I bought her some old-fashioned Amelia Earhart cockpit goggles, a leather aviator's cap, and a scarf. Over that holiday break, I gave her these gifts and told her that I loved her. She wasn't alarmed by my saying this, but she was less ready to jump to conclusions. My dad says that it can't be love now, she said. It can only be infatuation. He says it takes years for real love to develop. I was willing to accept this. She wasn't saying, I don't love you. She just wasn't ready to say those three big words yet. I got it. This might be hard to believe, but I was happy to wait. I was actually proud of myself for this, feeling wise beyond my years in my maturity and patience. Besides, we kept on dating and kissing. But my parents were leery of this new relationship. They never demeaned my feelings or used that condescending phrase, puppy love. But they were concerned that I had fallen so hard for Cheryl that I might derail, either by getting my heart broken or by being so caught up in my relationship with her that my schoolwork would suffer. there was a socio-political backdrop to this. My 18th birthday loomed in the near future, and I would soon become eligible for the draft. The Vietnam War was still very much on, and we were all hoping that college deferments would keep me out of the military. Ergo, I needed to keep my grades up. I thought that I had forever slipped off the bubble wrap that my parents had kept me in as a boy, but now it came back. Their protectiveness of me went into overdrive. They issued an edict that I could only go on one date a week with Cheryl, believing that I was moving too fast. Forbidding me from riding my bike in the street when I was little was one thing. But this was a whole new level of controlling behavior. I was angry. My response was to prepare a presentation for my parents, in which I cited other boy-girl couples in my grade. I had conducted a survey of them and compiled the data, which demonstrated that every other couple besides Cheryl and me was spending more time together. This did little to persuade Mom and Dad. "Look, Cheryl's a great girl," Dad said. "But you've got a lot going on in your life, and the more you hang around with a girl, that's how you end up with unwanted teen pregnancies. You're not married. You're not even engaged. She's your girlfriend. That's fine, but these other couples you're talking about, they're acting like they're already married." I knew that my parents weren't accusing Cheryl specifically of being a gold digger. As controlling as they were acting out of love. They felt responsible for the fact that their son was famous, and they knew that fame could have ugly ramifications. They were also thrown by how serious I was about this, my first real relationship with a girl. They suggested that I should consider dating other girls before I got in too deep with this one, which only made me angrier. I felt humiliated and overly policed. As my weeks with Cheryl turned into months, her father, who was more accepting of our relationship than my parents were, which is saying a lot since he was a conservative religious man who was a registered Republican and a member of the NRA, invited me to join him and Cheryl for an overnight camping trip. Cheryl passed along the invitation and made the conditions clear. "My dad will be there, and it'll be fun. And you'll have your own tent, of course." I presented this offer to Mom and Dad and got a flat no. Then I had a bright idea that maybe, if I had sweet, honorable, charming Cheryl explain the setup to them instead of me, they would relent. Disaster. I could not have been more wrong. With an ingratiating smile on her face, Cheryl made her case to my parents in our living room. Mom, who was normally so easygoing and people-pleasing, issued a cutting rebuttal. "Why are you pushing us on this?" she told Cheryl. "We said no. We barely know anything about you, and we know nothing about your father." For the first time, Cheryl got angry at me. She felt that I had walked her into a trap. That had not been my intention, of course, but it was the reality. And now she was convinced that her boyfriend's mother didn't like or trust her.
Ron was kind of a nerd. It didn't matter that he was a TV star and a household name. He was a pimply-faced, straight-arrow 16-year-old. I was thrilled that he now stood a chance of getting some action. So I had no separation anxiety about losing my big brother to his new girlfriend. I liked Cheryl right away, and I saw how happy Ron was. I defended their relationship to Mom and Dad and resented on Ron's behalf the draconian restrictions that they had placed on his dating life. It just wasn't fair. This doesn't mean that I was above being a pesky little brother. I was the hee-hee man, let's not forget. We had a rec room in the lower level of the guest house out back, underneath Dad's office. Ron and Cheryl would inevitably gravitate toward there, looking for a place to be alone. But Mom made it known that she didn't want them to be in the rec room by themselves, lest they start necking, or worse. For me, Mom's warning was like an invitation. I took it upon myself to be a busybody. One day, when Cheryl was over, I scurried off to the rec room and hid behind a couch. Sure enough, Ron and Cheryl walked in and started to kiss. I sprang up and said, "Guess what? Clint's here." I was a sick little bastard. Cheryl just giggled, but Ron was pissed. His limited time with her was sacrosanct. And, little brother mischief aside, I respected that.
As this tension over my dating life went on, I challenged Mom and Dad. What about it was bugging them so much? Mom told me that she was worried primarily about me getting Cheryl pregnant. I replied that Cheryl and I were not yet doing the thing that causes pregnancies. She didn't believe me. She had clocked my furtive visits to the rec room with Cheryl and worried about how late my dates went. "Oh, come on," she said. "How can you spend that much time with her without going all the way?" Wow, this was rich coming from someone who, though she and Dad hadn't yet revealed this truth to me, had lived in sin with her boyfriend in New York City and eloped with him when they were 21 and 20. But then that was probably one of the reasons why Mom was so suspicious. She had been a free spirit at my age, and now it was the early 1970s, a much more sexually permissive time than that of her youth. I was telling the truth, though. Cheryl and I weren't having sex. Sure, we were necking and petting, to use the terminology then still in use. But that was it. Intimacy was new for both of us, and I didn't want to push Cheryl or rush ourselves as a couple. As my relationship with her continued, Dad became more sympathetic, even though he and Mom remained united in their clampdown. Just in case I did choose to become sexually active, he wanted me to be prepared. So in the same plain-spoken way that he explained masturbation and the bathroom graffiti at Desilu Cahuenga to me, he sat me down for another talk. First, he presented me with a copy of Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. This was a recently published book by a doctor named David Rubin that had become an international bestseller, the first mainstream sex manual that wasn't considered dirty or deviant. Listen, you don't have to be embarrassed by sex, and this book will answer a lot of questions you may have, Dad said. It's good to have the answers because sex is a natural part of life. If you ever have other questions, let me know. I never did hit Dad up for advice. That was just too uncomfortable to contemplate. But I avidly paged through the book. Still, I couldn't bear my parents' rules about how much time I got to spend with Cheryl. So, I developed some workarounds. For starters, I pretended that I had found religion. We were not churchgoers in our household. But Cheryl went with her dad every Sunday and was, in those days, pretty pious and hardcore, sufficiently so that she was genuinely a little worried about my soul. So I told my parents that I had become interested in Cheryl's Southern Baptist faith and wanted to go to church with her. They couldn't object to their boy going to church, could they? Even this proved to be a difficult negotiation. Mom and Dad said that I could go as long as I came back immediately after church let out. I managed to pry out of them an allowance of half an hour of further time with Cheryl on Sundays beyond church. Next, I declared I was trying out for the cross-country team at Burroughs, not because I enjoyed running. I had a scheme. To try out, I would need to train, right? Mom and Dad permitted me an hour and a half in the afternoons to go running. So I put on my shorts and running shoes and jogged over to Cheryl's house, which was only a mile and a half away. Then I would spend about an hour hanging out with her. When my time was almost up, Cheryl drove me back to within a couple of blocks of my house. From there, I sprinted pell-mell up to our door so that my face was convincingly flushed and my hair sufficiently sweaty. "Whew! Good workout," I said when I walked in, bending over to rest my hands on my knees as I breathed deeply. I don't think my folks bought it for a second, but they tolerated it. It took some time for my parents to reach detente with Cheryl, or with the idea of Cheryl and me as a couple. But simply by sticking together, Cheryl and I demonstrated that we were for real. It was one thing for Mom and Dad to have doubts about a pair of moony 16-year-olds, and quite another to question our commitment by the time we were 19 and still inseparable. One notable moment in the thawing process involved our monkey. Yes, you heard that right. Cheryl and her dad kept a pretty bizarre array of animals at their place. An anteater, skunks, a snapping turtle that lived on a diet of beef heart, and a mature woolly monkey named Willie. There was a local pet store that we enjoyed visiting to check out the exotic birds and reptiles that they had for sale. One day, Cheryl and I dropped in and saw that the store had a new occupant, a juvenile woolly, a female. Cheryl swooned over this beautiful little creature with deep, soulful eyes. So I decided to surprise Cheryl. I returned to the store alone and bought the monkey for $500. That's something I would never do now. Doing so would support a black market of cruel animal traffickers. But it was perfectly legal then, and Sugar, as we named her, was a great companion, gentle and fun to be around. She lived well into the years when Cheryl and I got married and moved in together. She was basically our first child. When Cheryl was still living at her dad's, I asked my parents if she could bring Sugar on one of her visits to our house. I promised them that Sugar would wear a diaper indoors just in case she felt the urge to go. They said yes. On the appointed day, I went to pick up Cheryl and drive her over. When we entered, she witnessed a sight that moved her to no end. Mom and Dad had hung ropes and lines everywhere. They had effectively transformed our house into a play space for a woolly monkey. This was when Cheryl realized that things were going to be okay between her and my parents. I still wasn't feeling so great about my professional life. The period between the Wild Country and the Smith family had marked the biggest slump of my career. For a 9-month stretch, I wasn't cast in anything. I disappeared from television. Factor in the adolescent rage that courses through a boy when he's in his mid-teens, and you have a volatile situation. I was getting mad at everything my parents said to me. I was getting mad at myself when I had a bad basketball practice. I was getting mad at the phone for not ringing. I felt a constant urge to put my fist through the sliding glass door that led to the backyard. I never did so, but I did spend a lot of time angrily slamming a basketball against the garage door, making as much noise as I could. I felt diminished and betrayed by the entertainment industry. I kept shouting, "I'm missing the boat!" To this day, I can't articulate precisely what was on this boat that I was convinced I was missing. But I was inconsolable most of the time. Poor Mom couldn't do anything right by me, but she tried. Mostly, she and Dad did their best to soothe me and assure me that this moment would pass. Inwardly, I recognized that my family was what kept me afloat, the big Christmases, going to the movies with Dad, coaching Clint in the Howard's Hurricanes. Dad and Hoke Hal let me hang out with them during their writing sessions, inviting me to help them crack an episode of a TV show that they were writing. I appreciated all of this, even as I told myself that I never again wanted to be in this position. I began to imagine, pun intended, a future in which I would build my own company and have control over my creative output so that I would never again have to wait around to be hired. Part of what I loved about Cheryl was that she and I, as a couple, had nothing to do with show business. Sure, she listened to my war stories and was supportive of my ambition to graduate to directing. But she was in no way dependent on my dreams. She had dreams of her own. She was going to go to college and major in psychology. She was going to travel the world. I had no intention of co-opting Cheryl. We could dream our dreams together. The Smith Family was a dull, indifferent show. The guy who put it together, Don Federson, had struck gold when he built My Three Sons around a film star of yesteryear, Fred McMurray, and he thought he could do the same with Henry Fonda. But the quality of the scripts just wasn't there. And after a few episodes, Hank Fonda's enthusiasm flagged. His work ethic remained, and he remained respectful of the cast and crew, but he didn't have Andy Griffith's passion to elevate the material he was performing, to make every scene matter. I learned from this experience that the work doesn't just take care of itself. You need a leader, a champion. We continued into a second season only because Fonda had a lucrative contract that he wanted to see through. One lowlight of this period was an appearance on The Dating Game, which shared a network, ABC, with the Smith family. I hated the idea. I was already committed to Cheryl, and I found the whole concept ridiculous. But ABC's publicity department was adamant, kicking off a decade-long string of embarrassments for me at the hands of those folks. In a few years for Happy Days, I would be suffering my way through guest appearances on Donnie and Marie and Captain Antoniel's variety show, which is not a knock on any of the aforementioned, but on my hopelessness as a song and dance man. It's not fun being on TV when you absolutely know that your performance sucks. I did The Dating Game twice. The first time, I was one of the three bachelors competing to win a date with a young lady. I wasn't picked, which was fine. Well, not really. If I was going to go to the trouble of putting on a suit and sitting there like a dork with an audience watching, I damn well wanted to win. As my dad used to say, you can't separate the pleasure from the pain. So honestly, I was pissed not to be picked. The second time, ABC told me that I was going to be the one asking the questions and doing the choosing. It was a special double date episode where two lucky couples would go on a romantic cruise to the beautiful island of Catalina, with lots of plugs promised for the Smith family, Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on ABC. Cheryl and I did not have an open relationship, and I was not shopping around for anyone else. So only grudgingly did I agree to go through the motions. Cheryl pretended not to find this showbiz work obligation to be demeaning and offensive. The costume department at the Smith family helped me pick out a smart, double-breasted blazer and a pair of chalk-striped pants. I went on the show and asked questions that someone else had written for me. The girl I picked turned out to be a lovely young woman with long blonde hair named Nola. When it came time to enjoy my date of a lifetime with this comely lass who I didn't know, Cheryl drove me to the port of Long Beach, where the boat to Catalina was launching. She was relieved when Nola showed up with a boyfriend in tow, seeing her off just as Cheryl was doing for me. The ABC cameras were assembled to capture this dewy new romance, but reader, it was a sham. More than that, it was sickening. Literally, within minutes of leaving the harbor, the choppy seas had sent all of us, Nola, me, and the other couple, to the railing. There was no respite from the nausea. Whether we went below decks to the cabins or stepped outside for fresh air, we all puked our guts out. Upon arriving at Catalina, we changed into evening dress for a luxurious dinner. While the cameras rolled, I held the chair for Nola, and we both sat down to perfectly prepared slices of roast beef served on fine bone china. We could not have been less hungry and made only gestural acknowledgments of the food on our plates, which was just as well because the captain of our boat announced that on account of the high waves and the demand for moorings, we would not be spending the night as planned on the island. Instead, we were sailing back to Long Beach right away. Nola and I reboarded the boat as the cameras clicked and whirred. That was the last I saw of her until the wee hours of the morning when we both disembarked, unsteady, exhausted, and green to the gills. I had called Cheryl ahead of time and asked her to pick me up. There she stood, waiting by her dad's Chrysler station wagon with a smirk on her face. I recounted to her the hardships that I had been through with this pretty mini-skirted girl in the name of network publicity. "Aw," she said, her voice thick with sarcasm. "That's really too bad."
I also did The Dating Game twice in this same period. They did a few adorable Pee-wee editions in prime time, with child actors of my vintage and bigger prizes at stake. Like Ron, I was not picked the first time I appeared, losing out on a trip to Hawaii. I developed a little piss stain on my trousers at the moment we went on stage and never recovered from that setback. I was already self-conscious about my physical appearance, the way kids are as they enter puberty. When I sized up the competition, I was relieved that the bachelorette made her pick blindly. The dudes in the other two chairs were taller and prettier than me. Miracle of miracles, the second time I went on the show, I got picked. The chooser was Eileen Barral, a flaxen-haired little beauty who was on ABC's Nanny and the Professor. I was nervous as hell. One of Eileen's questions was, "Name a vegetable that you are like." I don't know where this answer came from, but I blurted it out. "I'm like a tomato because I'm so juicy." It brought the house down and won me a chaperone trip to Alaska with Eileen. Mom accompanied me, and Eileen's dad accompanied her. Unlike Ron, I did not have a girlfriend and would not have minded going on a genuine date, whatever that meant for an 11-year-old. But right out of the box, I discovered that Eileen was way out of my league. It turns out that despite her diminutive stature, she was 4 years my senior and four times more mature than any girl in my school. She absolutely slaughtered me in games of checkers, chess, and Scrabble. We did enjoy some pleasant sightseeing in Nome and the native village of Kotzebue. It was cool that it stayed light for 20 hours a day, but no romance with the beautiful Miss Barral sparked.
Hank Fonda was a taciturn man. Between scenes, he spent his time on the Smith Family set crocheting, mostly floral patterns, lots of throw pillows in the Fonda household, I guess. Fonda remembered my father warmly from the Mr. Roberts tour and took a shine to me, giving me acting tips that he had picked up in the course of his four-decades-long film career. One was about pausing for dramatic effect. He caught me doing this before I began one of my lines and advised me not to do so again. If you take the pause before your lines, they'll cut it out because they always want to tighten the film up in the editing, he said. Start with a couple of words, then do the pause, and then finish your line. That way they can't ruin your performance. He also taught me how to eat efficiently on camera. Eating shots are problematic from a continuity standpoint. If the director cuts from a wide shot to a close shot and your chewing in the first doesn't match up with your chewing in the second, the shots aren't usable. The script supervisor has to take notes during the master shot and subsequently remind you exactly when you took your bite of toast and when you took your sip of coffee. Fonda taught me never to wing it. If you plan it, you won't ever hear from the script supervisor, he said. For a breakfast scene, he would tell the property master in advance, "I'm going to eat the wedge of grapefruit when I sit down. I'll take a sip of coffee when I turn to my wife. I'll have a bite of eggs when I talk to Ronnie, and I'll grab a bite of toast when I get up to leave." I followed suit, and the crew appreciated the time and the toast that I saved them. About the only other thing that truly animated Hank on set was my interest in directing. His first love was the theater, but he could tell that I was different. "I love the theater, and that's an actor's medium," he said. "But you love movies, and that's a director's medium." He took a lot of pride in his son Peter, who had co-written Easy Rider with Dennis Hopper and was now directing a Western called The Hired Hand. Knowing how much I loved movie history, Hank happily regaled me with stories of working with John Ford, his most frequent director, and Preston Sturges. For my 17th birthday, he gave me two books, The Film Director as Superstar, a collection by Joseph Gelmes of his interviews with iconoclastic filmmakers, and Film Forum, Essays in Film Theory by the pioneering Russian director Sergei Eisenstein. It was a magnanimous gesture and a confidence boost when I was having my doubts about acting. So, as depressing as it was to work on a mediocre, going-nowhere show, I came out of the Smith family supercharged to chase my dream. Like Bob Totten, Hank Fonda was a formidable man who had sized me up as director material and issued a command: go for it.